Welcome back, Critical Gamers. This is the Crazy Kirby Kid, or just Kirby Kid for short. I recently published an article series explaining in detail a new theory I have on the gaming industry. This theory will change the way you think about games, talk about games, and value games. I call this theory the Trigon Theory of Video Games. I explain it all in my 6-part series on my blog, Critical Gaming. For episode 3 of Critical Cast, I want to support the theory with voices from the gaming industry. I think it's important for you to hear the voices, cares, concerns, complaints, and comments that I listened to develop the theory in the first place. We will be listening to a lot of audio clips in this episode. I'll do my best to indicate who's speaking in each clip, but it's far more important to simply listen to what's being said and consider the motivations of each speaker. You'll hear from game developers, critics, gamers, spanning a wide range of perspectives. The Trigon Theory is a 3-part way of viewing the video game medium. One view is games as art, which values the expression of ideas, listening, learning, and reflecting the world through the structure of game design. Games as technology is a view that values games that ride the wave of technology, so that games become a way of better appreciating technology. This view also greatly values iteration, refinement, no matter how subtle. And then there's games as business. In this view, games are at the service of players. Anything the player wants or desires drives this view, and the developers respond to these desires in order to generate profit above all else. This view values more passive entertainment, emotional, evocative experiences, and novel experiences. But I'll get into all these views in great detail shortly, but for now, we have to talk a little bit more about what video games are. Video game is a term used to describe games and non-games. Instead of just using interactive movies or applications, software, or making up new terms to describe various non-gaming experiences, we tend to call anything that we can stick inside of our computers or consoles a game as long as it's minimally interactive.
These games are just as good whether you're rolling a dice or not. Zork is just as good whether you're kind of playing as a piece of fiction or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's a great experience. Just let it go. We don't have to care. We're in this weird position where we keep apologizing, going, oh, we don't know if that's a game or not. Shouldn't we be actually shouting and saying, hey, listen, all these things are games. We are all of this. We're making this. We're evolving. We're diversifying. We're providing these incredible experiences that are going wider and wider and wider. We need to stop worrying about whether they're games or not, and we need to start shouting to the world, this is the best medium on the planet right now, bar none.
Now we have games with hours and hours of cinematic cutscenes, games with endless interactive activities, and games with other features that complicate our understanding of what games are. I have defended gameplay in depth in an article series on my blog called A Defense of Gameplay. In it, I defend what a game is, which helped me frame what gameplay is, which allowed me to explain the kind of experiences and messages that can best be conveyed through gameplay. In A Defense of Gameplay, I opened up with this bold statement. Modern gamers do not like gameplay. I designed the statement to get people thinking critically about what games are by presenting a seemingly absurd statement that gamers, people who play games, do not like playing games, gameplay. But is this statement really so absurd? We'll get to the bottom of this question and more as we explore the Trigon Theory. So first up is games as art.
Games as art.
If you look at a game as just some kind of commercial product that gives you all these sort of things, then you're really kind of like denying that it has any value as a piece of culture or as a piece of art.
I mean, this is an art form. I'm not even having that fucking debate. Like, this is art. So can we just stop that? I'm not even going there.
Like, they're showing off for the other speedrunners and doing right. stuff. Like, the Castlevania guy actually did this thing where he would throw down holy water. Perfect. And it looks like he's, like, cooking wieners, they call it. Like, they call it a campfire. Like, the cooking That's wieners awesome. On the campfire.
Oh, wow.
It's like, it's like, becomes its own, like, crude, weird art form, you know, yeah. where...
What's the story you're trying to tell? What are you trying to achieve, like, creatively or artistically through your game?
But like Go, poker can be approached as a spiritual discipline, as a martial art. It isn't common, but it can be done. And if you approach it seriously, poker invites you to treat it as a martial art.
The following explains the view of video games as art. If you're burned out on this particular topic, after experiencing many derailed discussions and convoluted definitions, then I suggest throwing out the terms altogether. Forget the labels and categories of art and video game for the time being, and let's just focus on what art does and how art affects us instead. In many ways, art is a statement, intentionally designed to say something or ask a question. And even the mere existence of a work is a clear statement in itself.
Well, Cartlife might be able to answer this in its existence, answer this question about where those things can cross over really cleanly.
Mm-hmm. Art seems to be the thing that people create when they have something inside of them that must be conveyed, something that needs to exist. And sure, to some, creating art is merely a job or a passing hobby rather than a way of life, but the art itself still works regardless of the creator's motivation. We use art in many ways to learn about the world, to stretch our minds, and to relate to the hidden goings-on inside of other people. And all of these uses of art are important. Video games, in the broadest sense of the term, easily conveys ideas. And some ideas are very abstract, like functions, strategies, and design spaces. And some ideas are very concrete, like the stories of heroes fighting against the forces of evil.
This is Spartan 117. Can anyone hear me? Over.
Isolate that signal. Master Chief, you mind telling me what you're doing on that ship?
Sir, finishing this fight.
And some experiences are fleeting, happening in your mind as your brain clicks to a solution. While all types of interactive media we call video games can be embraced as art, there are very specific questions, ideas, and structures that can only be conveyed with works that fit a more narrow definition of game. At their simplest, video games ask a very simple and important question. Can you do this? Well, can you? Do you have the skills to press the buttons as quickly as possible in a reflex-based game? Do you have the mental capacity to remember a string of 50 colors in a Simon Says type game? Or do you have the ability to keep a steady beat in any music rhythm game? Do you have control over your own fingers when you're manipulating a controller? Do you have what it takes? This is why games are unique from other mediums in the way that they convey ideas and experiences. Games can express ideas in passive ways through the presentation of visuals, oral, and tactile stimuli, but they also ask something of us and take the experience a step further, by giving us an opportunity to answer back. Yes, video games can actually test us and reflect us much in the same way that exams do in school. And it is through these tests, these questions and answers, that we have a unique and artistic way of experiencing ideas, interacting with concepts, and most importantly, measuring what we're made of.
Yeah, it does, and it's frustrating, but I think I agree with James when he says that it shows a deep level of design in saying there's these different paths you can choose, and it's up to the player to decide.
In these games, the choices were very organically tied to the gameplay and how you followed your way through the game. Now, to be fair, this is not something that's brand new and never before seen in game development, but that really is probably the best trick and one of the most desirable things that you can have in a game experience these days, because there is no equitable situation in any other types of entertainment media out there. That's a level of player investment and player engagement into that world, into the gameplay mechanics, that when you do things right, I mean, it really was one of the most satisfying moments I've had in playing a game this year. And then with XCOM, and then, of course, getting to arrange all of your army men to see if all of these ideas and these decisions you made we're going to pan out. And I think it really is investment that makes us connect to these games so much, because you're so into wanting to go back and play it again.
The thing that Diablo 3 brings to the equation that I found so wonderful in relation to Diablo 2 and the Torchlights is the way the skill system worked to allow for myriad different builds that were all feasible.
Okay,
and that creativity and that the allowance for different takes on how to build your character, and there wasn't just the one best way to do it. that it was really about gameplay style. It was about fun, different variations on a theme.
I love the successes that I get. The gameplay of doing that is what keeps bringing you guys back in.
In some ways, we need art to help us realize who we are and what we think. Like acquiring a clear language to express oneself, art can give us the ideas that we take in, collect, break apart, combine to give us a better way to understand what we think. There's nothing like games as a personal measuring tool. The thing about measuring tools is they work best when you can take that tool and measure more than one thing with it. So when I say measure here, I'm talking about that foundational first step in understanding who you are at the most deepest, hidden, untouchable part of your being.
I think that's actually, I was trying to think like why it's so popular, and what I was deciding was that it basically, speedrunning creates like a universal kind of currency by which anybody can compete in a game. Do you know what I mean? Even if a game is not like score based or something, right. You know what I mean? Like Yoshi's Island, right. Or Super Metroid or
the
something.
Universal
there's no
currency
score,
being time, you mean.
But it's time. Right. Like, yeah. It's like how fast can you do it? And so
in this way, external measures are the first step to relating to others, and then empathizing with others, and finally understanding one another. By asking that one simple question, video games don't just ask us to relate to ideas and experiences, they demand that we change ourselves to understand them. To build the skills to play more complex and challenging games, we have to eat, breathe, and sleep the rules, particulars, complexities, and details until they become second nature. Until they become a part of us.
And the thing is that poker is not just about learning about this stuff, but it's about the process of changing the way you think. Part of the beauty of poker is looking at your own mind as it wraps itself around these ideas and you're doing this for its own sake. You're not doing this to become a better scientist or politician or doctor. But to just get at a particular kind of beauty in thinking itself. Poker is a sculpture that is carved out of our thoughts and emotions and decisions and the world.
Games and gameplay are about learning and thought and execution and measuring and finding out what one is made of by reducing what one is about to better conform to the system. It's about squeezing yourself into a more narrow shape, the shape that the game frames. A willingness to listen, to be open-minded, and to humble oneself before the task at hand are qualities that make engaging with art so meaningful.
But these are the rules that I tried and mostly failed to live by in my poker play. Think of poker as an established discipline of which you are a student. Approach the game as a student with humility. Don't just plop down in front of the computer and toss out your game and see what happens. Enter into the game as if you were entering into a sacred place.
The next segment is called Introducing Games as Technology.
Games as
Technology! Some gamers view games as a medium to reflect the current state of technology rather than the ideas and messages of creators. Think of this view as games as technology, or games as engineering, or games as computational visualizers. However you label it, this view of video games values and appreciates a unique set of qualities of video games that don't overlap with the view of games as art. In general, we appreciate technology not in abstract milestones of progress. We appreciate technology via gadgets and how they affect our everyday lives in a very hands-on, perceivable way.
Before you left for CES, we talked about this, and you were not excited about 4K, and now you've come back and you are excited about 4K.
Well, they are pretty glamorous. They
right?
Are, yeah.
This is
so like the technology side of me says, yeah, that would be awesome, like great resolution, fantastic screens, and then
technology is constantly advancing in a wave that moves at a frightening pace. And when you think you have a grasp of it, there's always more.
As I understand it, Moore's law dictates that the number of transistors on a chip will double roughly every 24 months.
Now, does that mean that the speed also doubles?
Theoretically.
God, if you'd double your speed even once, I'd have an easier time staying awake while you were talking.
Yeah.
To help us encounter, interact with, understand, and embrace technology, some look to video games as the cutting edge where technology meets entertainment. The idea is, even if you can't understand polygonal tessellation, multi-cell processing, dead reckoning, and netcode, or any other technical happenings, you can appreciate the video games that are only possible because of these cutting-edge advancements. This is why so many gamers value graphics so much.
Anybody have any suggestions on that?
PC Master Race.
Okay, yeah. That's really the only way to go.
Okay, well, I'll do it then. Yeah. Maybe.
Oh. Nice. PC Master Race?
PC Master Race.
All right. Very good, yeah.
And why gamers get so excited about new hardware.
Hello, it is the final Cecil or something of 2012. The big thing I do believe is going to be happening in 2013 is we're going to have two new consoles. At the very least, we're going to have one new console. And if it's only one, then that other console maker has made a horrible, terrible mistake. I think it's going to be a healthy thing because it's going to reinvigorate the industry. It's going to make the industry feel a little bit more alive. And all I know is it's about time. A lot of the malaise I think we've been feeling with games the past couple of years has to do with the fact that we haven't had a reinvigorating spike in technology. And
because video games are made through engineered software, our industry also has many sequels, updates, patches, expansions, and interactive releases that refine and tweak over time. I think gamers and engineers have similar attitudes. There's something special about how closely video games bring technology, engineering, goal-oriented thinking, problem-solving, and visual systems all together.
Welcome! Got a selection of good things on sale, stranger. What are you buying? Is that all, stranger? Not enough cash, stranger.
Games and business.
For the view of games as business, profit is the bottom line. In this view, games are just like any other desirable that can be produced and profited from. In this view, the gamers are the most important factor to consider, and everything bends around their time, attention, and spending dollars. In this view, there are no good or bad design practices. Just what is successful, lucrative, and popular.
I don't think I've heard. I wonder why.
And did you actually know about Casual Connect, Paul?
I'd heard the name.
And when I first went there, they were talking about the design behind Diner Dash and how do you get moms to come in and play your game on the web. Little did anybody really know, in the next coming years, Casual Connect is these casual developers are starting to bring in huge amounts of money through like Farmville type experiences, mm-hmm. with Facebook games, with mobile now. And after the first couple of years, I started to really notice a lot more of like these venture capitalists walking around. Before it was just like dudes in t-shirts. Now it's guys in really nice suits. And you can start to smell the money coming mm-hmm. through, right?
While games as technology rides the wave of the future, games as business has a much less straightforward and less stable trajectory. Over time, trends come and go. The economy rises and falls. Electronic components become cheaper, and dreams change shape. And it's the job of savvy businessmen and women to navigate this constantly shifting landscape. Growing up, I remember wanting a Talkboy.
You can have lots of high-tech fun with Tiger's Talkboy tape recorder.
A Yak Back.
Yak Back gives you the last word.
Yak Back.
Yak Back.
Tiger handheld electronic game.
And that's doubly true in Tiger's new Jurassic Park handheld game.
Tamagotchi.
It's Tamagotchi Connection.
Gigapet and Lego Mindstorm Construction Kit. There was a time when all of these toys were popular, but ultimately what's cool one day becomes uncool, forgotten, or ubiquitous down the line. I bring this up because it's what's cool, interesting, or fun in the world of entertainment that matters. Because we don't need entertainment in the same way we need food, shelter, and safety. Entertainment is largely viewed as something we consume with our free or downtime, something created for the sole purpose of our amusement. So selling entertainment deals more specifically with how people feel, what they want, and more specifically, what people feel they want.
But I think the average user of Farmville is a was it 48 or 58 year old woman?
Yeah.
I think I remember reading that, and don't quote me on that. Actually, you can, but I don't care if I'm wrong, but I know it's up there, and that user doesn't care as long as they're having a good time.
Dude, look at the background. Yeah, that's pretty neat.
So polished!
Why don't they make a 3D game that looks like that and feels like that?
No fucking clue.
They don't.
Don't ask me.
They don't. There's no fucking game.
I don't know. I wish.
Name a game that looks and feels like that. Like
that game just, like, it just, like, pulled my heart out and, like, held it in front of my face and was just like, feel feelings. Feel these feelings you feel.
Gamers want fun experiences, and companies want profit. And perhaps these desires are insatiable. Still, there's a limited amount of time in the day, a limited amount of potential customers, and a limited amount of money to go around. These limitations force consumers and gamers to make a choice about what they invest in. And typically, we seek more fun for our dollar. And for these reasons, certain trends will emerge in an entertainment market. In the entertainment world, where people make decisions based on how they feel and what they think they want, the less complex and more stimulating content tends to be more popular on a wide scale. Some consider such content the equivalent of junk food, and while an exclusive diet on junk food has serious health drawbacks, the choices we make about the entertainment we consume has less obvious, yet still serious effects.
What's interesting about the game over and above the IP?
Well, that's a fair question, absolutely, and I will honestly say that the IP is a really big draw for that particular game. When you're talking about pure gameplay mechanics, I haven't played enough of the game to give you a complete analysis of what I think is why it's better than anything else, and in all honesty, I'm going to say you're right. Like, a lot of my excitement for this game relies on the IP.
It's IP-based, so do you see...
And I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing.
I don't either, but...
I describe playing video games as work, because games are typically very engaging, requiring players to build real skills. At their best, this work is fun, in a way that doesn't feel like a chore. And at their worst, video games feel like a nightmare class in the school of hard losses. For this reason, the gameplay experience of video games is a tough sell. So to make video games more attractive, many developers leverage engaging yet passive elements. By using story, music, visuals, low to no difficulty, and other design choices, developers have widened the appeal of video games to a broader audience by using the elements of non-games.
I struggle to try and explain my dislike for fail states beyond seeing game over is not fun, and I'm playing games for fiction and for fun, and while I want a challenge, I want the challenge to not put me to the point where I feel like I've had time wasted.
Games are all about mechanics. Games are not all about mechanics. Games are all about an experience for the user, and frankly, we throw whatever we need at the user to make them have that experience. I don't give a monkey's whether that's physics, AI, story, music, whatever it is. I want to have a good time.
It's the interactivity of playing the combat from Terra that I want, with the connection of place and lore of a Tolkien world like Lord of the Rings.
Wait, is any part of you picking that up again due to the fact that Tolkien's back in the zeitgeist?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
It doesn't hurt.
Yeah. No. It was kind of just, I want to try something new. This seems easy and low maintenance. I can just download it from Steam, and it was a really easy decision to make, and it's an easy game to pick up.
And you like the lore, and you know the place.
And it's an established IP. Like, I don't need to ask any questions. I know. That's Rivendell. Okay, cool.
That is my fiction that I like. You know, right. my primary fiction that I enjoy is video games. And that's always been my stance on that stuff.
There's nothing wrong with this basic approach. A skilled developer can blend many disparate elements into a cohesive whole. And ultimately, as long as the product is thoughtful, interesting, and well-made, I don't care how much gameplay it has. There's nothing wrong with viewing games as art, technology, or as a business. However, these three views, when put together, create some odd overlapping results and a range of subtle side effects. single game can satisfy all three Trigon views.
Trigon.
That is games as art, technology, and business.
Games as art,
technology,
and business.
A game that is designed around gameplay and the kind of learning, skill-building experience that is inherent to completing gameplay challenges can also be designed with the latest cutting-edge technologies. And if this cutting-edge technology and game design combination is also appealing to many people, it can be the most lucrative option from a business standpoint as well. In fact, it's not hard to identify times in the history of video games where individual games satisfied the aims of all three views simultaneously. Remember Super Mario Bros. Back when the NES released in the US? As far as consumer mass market technology went, the NES was cutting edge. From a hardware and a software standpoint, Super Mario Bros. Brought technology and innovation to the forefront. Super Mario Bros. Helped perfect and popularize the side-scrolling gameplay format, and Super Mario Bros. To this day is still one of the best examples I have found for excellence in game design. So with solid gameplay, new technologies, and a novel, fun experience, Mario had wide appeal. Based on what I have observed, my theory is that our industry resists growth in any one clear positive direction because it's actually moving in three different directions. These three directions are basically the three views of video games that I presented, which include the trends and motivations of gamers that hold these views. And more often than not, these views do not harmonize like with Super Mario Bros. In fact, it's becoming harder and harder for a game to satisfy all three views. And my theory is that video games, by their very nature, create this three-part tug of war. Software is a big factor in what games are, how they're made, and how we can appreciate them. Software and digital computing are what video games are made of, but creating software using hardware and a coding language that can listen and interact with the player is something relatively new and beyond the understanding of most people. So because the video game medium is digital, where there is nothing appreciable about its parts outside of the specific digital systems to read the code and other electronic parts to produce the coded information, video games and technology are strongly tied together.
Hollywood dudes. The Hollywood dudes are like, yeah, you set up a new company, a production company. It's small, it's light, it's lean. It brings in contractors for the, you know, you hire people for the purposes of making the movie. When it's over, you let them all go. It's light, it's lean, it's mean. You game people are idiots that you don't do this. I'm going to go into the industry and I'm going to change everything by doing this. And then the guy flames out and everything sucks. And he's like, well, I don't know what happened. This game guys are jerks, right? And there's a reason. It's not because we're stubborn. It's not because we're idiots. Look at companies. Look at animation studios who make movies. They don't do that. Why? Because they have software. Software is the difference between Hollywood and us. Because software is a big, rickety, old, leaky machine that you made yourself, and you're going to be using it from project to project to project. The Hollywood guys don't have that. Unless you're in animation, in which case, they have persistent jobs and they don't do the production company thing.
I'm also kind of the opinion generally, and this is an opinion that I make, you know, with obviously like a pretty limited total amount of experience in terms of like just breadth and volume, but like just knowing a lot of people who having a lot of good friends at a lot of different kinds of studios and like having experienced a couple different environments and like just having, you know, before that reporting on this industry for years, like I'm kind of the opinion that software development in a like explicitly creative product just doesn't make sense past a certain size. Like I just don't think it scales. I think the way software is made, as opposed to the way like a film is made or a book is written or an album is recorded or something, the way software is made, the way an interactive piece of software is made, I really do not think it scales up past a certain size of development team and length of budget, length of time. I think
without
it's just,
becoming completely without what, like
without collapsing under its own weight or sabotaging itself or
becoming
going
completely
way over
incoherent.
But, like, exactly, like
because technology is always advancing along this wave of the future. Video games are also tied to business in a strange and perhaps unique way.
Next steps, have a business plan. You need to have a biz guy. You're an idiot if you don't have one. So even a friend who's savvy with it.
Because advanced technology quickly becomes much cheaper to produce, it becomes a matter of course to embrace these advancements. We must update our systems and our controllers and our hardware to continue to enjoy video games. Programmers work with new technology to create products that work on new technology. And as video game developers are swept along this wave, businesses are needed to manage the costs.
That really rubbed me the wrong way was when I was talking to people from companies we'd be interested in working with in some capacity. From a lot of these guys, the first question out of their mouths was, what's your monetization strategy, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that in the current space in games industry, so much discussion is being had right now about the pricing of games, right? Or like the marketing of games or...
Making games isn't cheap.
This is my general... stereotype of hardcore video game fans, and they're how they just don't understand the money and the finance behind game development, and they look at even like a price tag of or like a funding goal for Public at $500,000, like, you filthy
money grubbing,
you know, and like, this, are you kidding me, man? Like, we're in mid December right now, and you know, we're getting down there in terms of like the funds that we have left. Now granted, we have another investment coming in January, but I bet people listening to this, like, how could you burn through $500,000 on this title? Trust me, it's not only easy to do, but it's like it's necessary to do a game of great ambition. And I look at your title, and you know, $160,000 is not a lot of money to make the game that you guys are making.
Yep.
You do that inside of a studio, whether it's like EA or Activision or whatever, you're millions right out of the gate. Like, no question.
These businesses are under great pressure to make money in an increasingly competitive market where the landscape is constantly changing. By my theory, video games cannot separate easily from the views of games as technology and games as business. But unlike these two views, games as art is a relatively disadvantaged view. The products we commonly call video games don't need gameplay to be entertaining or interactive. In the pursuit of entertainment, most people don't want to work for their fun, so it's clear that though we all are called gamers, not all of us value gameplay. I found there to be a lack of conversation about gameplay nearly everywhere I look, including GDC, gaming forums, and personal conversations. I found that even for games designed with a heavy focus on gameplay, many of the most devoted fans most enjoy the non-gameplay aspects of the experience.
I guess, like, I have just a wide viewpoint of what a game is, right?
Yeah.
Like, they still, I mean, it's still required.
I do too, just for the record. Yeah.
I mean, I guess I'm just saying, like,
we haven't nominated it for Game of the Year. I just don't think it is the game of the year.
I mean, I have my reasons why I think it's Game of the Year, but that's more emotional than it is gameplay wise.
It's as if these gamers are blind to gameplay. It's as if they cannot see the parts, see the systems working, or appreciate gameplay for the rich experiences that only it can offer. Most do not have the language to talk about gameplay, and this is something that I've been working on for years. It doesn't help that the critical discourse on video games is utterly lacking either. Over 95% of the critical material I read on games is focused on feelings and vague experiences and story elements. It doesn't help that many developers bend their design around Metacritic, and Metacritic is made up of reviews from writers who are neither very critical or insightful about gameplay. And when the tops of the discourse are lacking, I can't expect the general gamers to be any better about expressing ideas on gameplay. When you lack the language to understand gameplay, you also lack the ability to express what you like and dislike about it. The whole second episode of Critical Cast was on expression, and I go into more detail about that there. Eventually, these gameplay-focused conversations don't happen. Then these gamers and designers will begin to overlook the games that specialize in gameplay features and experiences. And eventually, players will become blind to gameplay or the games as art view. And eventually, the industry will change to accommodate. Have we reached this point already? Is it too late to balance the scales?
Thank you.
The final points I want to make about the Trigon view of video games is on the limitations of each view. It's important to understand that though these views may initially seem like mere opinion, they are actually the result of deep beliefs and desires that powerfully shape our decisions. These underlying beliefs are opposed to each other, which in turn makes the three views of video games opposed to each other. The theory is, these irreconcilable beliefs are why there are so much internal tension and stagnated growth within the gamer culture. Because of the nature of these views, it's hard to create games that harmonize all three. And while a game can satisfy all three views, it's even harder for a player to hold all three views as their core beliefs.
What do you think about this? You can't let a puzzle intimidate you.
If you support the view of games as business, then you also support the idea of games as time wasters, games as mindless fun, games as distractions, games as just entertainment, and ultimately games as a service. Regardless of what gamers need, gamers make decisions on what they feel they want. And games as business isn't about what you need, but merely satisfying what you want based on what you're willing to pay for. So, the important question to consider is what gamers want, how gamers can get it, and what we're being sold.
I think it's just really important for gamers nowadays to understand when their games are backed by companies that are going to patch their games. It's very important.
I couldn't believe that Nintendo just didn't care about Brawl at all. They didn't patch anything, they didn't finish it, they released it early, you know, it's just they didn't put any work into it.
I just think that, you know, the marketing team tends to run Nintendo because, you know what, they haul in big dollars. You know what? With companies like that, it's very hard to argue because video games are a business and they have to make their money. But at the same point, you can't forget why you're making your money. Your communities and your followers are very important. Always important.
Gamers want meaningful experiences. Whether these experiences are intellectually interesting, emotionally stimulating, or appealing to our senses. Video games can appeal to many of our basic desires.
So many of the deepest, most beautiful games are forms of behavioral psychology in which the player is both the subject and the researcher.
Which is kind of surprising, and that's one of the things that came out in some of Scott Rigby's research, was that the things that keep people coming back for games and predict long-lasting value in games aren't fun, but are these other properties that happen to be the central aspects of self-determination theory. So let's just talk through those real quick, because it's pretty simple. The idea of self-determination theory is that we have our physical needs, you know, that we all know about. You know, you got to eat, you got to sleep, and you got to breathe, and all those things. But we also have psychological needs. And self-determination theory posits that there are precisely three psychological needs. And then if you don't have these, you go kind of batshit crazy, right? So these are these. The first one being competence. You have to feel like you're good at something. If you don't feel like you're good at something in your life, you become mentally unhealthy. Second one is autonomy. You want some freedom in what you do. And then the third one is relatedness, you know, connecting to other people. And if you have all three of these things, you have a good shot at being mentally healthy. Now, the thing that's interesting to think about is these three things are things that games are really good at.
And out of the entire range of meaningful experiences we can have with video games, more meaning requires more complexity, which ultimately requires us to work more to appreciate it. Complexities cannot be compressed. And likewise, there's no way to get more work out of a system by putting in less energy. Yet, this more for less concept is exactly what many gamers want if they're going to spend their money and time on a game. And it's this desire for more, meaning from less work, that profit-seeking companies will utilize. And to cater to this desire while simultaneously attempting to broaden the market and appeal to more gamers, developers tend to use a handful of specific design elements. I consider the following design elements, when taken to an extreme, to be anti-games as art. RPG leveling, achievements, random loot drops, open worlds, and even passive elements like story, music, and fancy visuals. There's nothing wrong with only appreciating video games as a tool to serve yourself, to relax, to turn off your brain, and to seek simple entertainment, or just to feel good. Just understand that when many gamers share this view, over time companies after your money above all else will adapt. The simple truth is, When there are more gamers who are unwilling to work to get more out of games, more companies will shift development away from making deep and complex content. Because watching TV is less work than reading or learning gameplay systems, more games will trade gameplay with interactivity, and then interactivity with passive entertainment. Instead of conveying the core ideas of a game through its interactive gameplay systems, more developers will use everything but gameplay to please gamers.
The interaction with the game in The Walking Dead is rather simplified, and it does, to a great degree, come down to an interactive video novella sort of approach.
Oh, yeah. Right, exactly.
I mean, I totally agree that Walking Dead is like an interactive story. Like, that's what you're an over-glorified story.
Yeah, and that's why I don't believe that it deserves to be called Game of the Year.
But I think one of the reasons why, you know, gamers and, you know, press have taken so kindly to the game is that there is no min-maxing. When Mass Effect 3 came out,
in the
Shack threads, like within hours, people were trying to figure out, okay, so what is the most efficient way to get the best stats and the best possible outcome out of this game? Because you knew how the game system worked. By stripping stripping the mechanics out of it, there, you know, if, do you drop the brick, yes or no? Like, neither one really is a better option than the other.
Using things extrinsic to gameplay to incentivize players to play games is dangerous. According to psychologists, such baiting is the perfect way to kill interest in gameplay and games.
It's very much true, and there are 30 or 40 years of psychological research that show that in many cases, the concept of giving people rewards to do something in order to kind of get them into the habit of doing it is often going to backfire. If you're interested in this, there's this great book, Punished by Rewards, by Alfie Cohn, where he does a great summary of the psychological research. You know, his subtitle, I love, The Trouble with Gold Stars, Incentive Plans, A's, Praise, and Other Bribes, because fundamentally what they found is anything where you bribe people to do something in order to get a reward ends up not giving you the results that you want. It ends up making people want to do that activity less, not more. So one of the first studies was all about children drawing pictures. The children like drawing pictures. You give them crayons, they'll draw pictures. Here's a question. What if you pay them to draw pictures? What happens then? Well, kids like getting paid, so paid plus drawing pictures must be just better. Well, it's not really better. What happens is, it's true, the children draw more pictures, but the pictures definitely appear to go down in aesthetic quality, right? So you get more pictures that are bad. If that's what you want, then maybe you're okay. Maybe that's good for you. But the really interesting part of the study is when they stop paying. And if they have two control groups, one where they don't pay them and one where they do, the group that they didn't pay them, they have them draw pictures, and afterwards they still like drawing pictures. The group where you pay them and then you take the money away, they now become very disinterested in drawing pictures. The idea that when you give someone rewards and prizes for doing something, it sends a message that says, this thing isn't worth doing unless you have this other system in place, which is often the exact opposite of what people are trying to intend when they start giving you incentives and rewards in order to get you to start doing something. So there's a lot you have to be careful about there.
Doing so is a great way to devalue games in the minds of players. In the same way, the free-to-play model is a potentially dangerous evolution of companies willing to do anything for gamer dollars. The model sends a message. It essentially shifts the value of a game away from the interactivity and gameplay and puts it on shortcutting boredom, social interactivity, and vanity items.
Trying to put free-to-play on top of a game is really difficult because you have to build a free-to-play game the right way, which is to let people play the game and be able to play more and more of the game and be able to play it all the way through free. Because honestly, the person who plays your free-to-play game a ton is way more valuable to you than any amount of money they spend. Because they're the people that are like really into your game, and they're bringing more people into the game.
Invested, well, they will sell your game more than anyone else will.
Any MMO maker right now that is not thinking about that in terms of the long term roadmap of their game as a contingency plan or something. I mean, you have to.
You don't know Jack doesn't. You don't know Jack is so approachable in the way it gives you constant reward for coming back.
Yes, it does.
What's more troubling is that the free-to-play models work best in games with the kind of elements that work against gameplay or games as art. Seeking to only satisfy oneself in the short term can only go so far. There are a few outcomes for the gamer who solely has the view of games as business. Some will be satisfied with what they get out of games and never ask for more.
I should say that I love video games that are just entertainment. I love video games that are disposable pop culture. But I also want a video game that I can teach my son, and we can play our whole lives, and he can teach his children, and they can play their whole lives. I want more video games that give me a space in which to entangle my mind with the mysterious infinite secrets of the universe.
But others will sense that they can get more out of their gaming experiences. And when the second type wants more, they'll make demands. They'll demand deeper stories or better graphics, more options, more customization, and of course, more new ideas.
Just because it isn't doing something super revolutionary, just because it wasn't something really
Chris
hot
Flaylor.
New.
And people look at it as, oh, it's not this transcendent 90-plus filled year. There's not a lot of, like, oh my god games that you couldn't miss that elevated the medium.
It's fun to play something new. Brawl's been out for like 1,000 years, and it's still not entertaining to watch.
Well, now
I'm entertained by Vinny's game of watch. I'll give him that credit.
And there's always that hype factor, but I agree. The new, the shiny, the wow factor of this game is all still so fresh that it's very entertaining to watch.
They'll ask for everything to be better and search for more meaningful experiences. Unfortunately, there will be few who will ask for more gameplay, and remember that most lack the language to ask for gameplay in the first place. There's only so many new, non-complex experiences with tons of options and customization and deeper stories that are possible. There's only so much that can be done for the unsatisfied gamer who is unwilling to change the way they consume games or dig deeper to appreciate its content.
What were considered to be the gigantic games of the year, right? The Assassin's
gigantic
Creed 3, the Diablo 3, the Borderlands 2, the Black Ops 2, the Halo 4. You look through this list of these games that were supposed to be the big things, that were the heavily, heavily marketed games. And while they were, none of them were a bad game. They were all very good games even. I don't think any of them delivered that like transcendent, like, oh my god, this is evolved or revolutionized gaming in any way.
It was highly polished iterative design.
Yeah, it was very good. It was very good. Did it blow our minds? Did it reset what we think of Halo the way Uncharted 2 did from Uncharted 1? That's why I think that those people have.
Are we going to go into every year now being like, oh, you've got to blow me away because there's going to come.
What's wrong with wanting that?
Well,
I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but like, how many times can you be blown away? Like, there's so
exactly,
many, only so many times
yeah.
you can have that new, super new experience.
All these demands are gamers asking for more meaningful experiences. And oddly enough, you'll never, almost never, hear anyone demand for more work, more learning, and a more strict system in their entertainment.
I don't want to get too far away, though, from this idea of getting rid of quests, because that's kind of what really...
I mean, I also said something about, like, you know, an MMO where combat was not the focus, where you could find something equally compelling. Can I throw a curveball really quick?
Sure.
I would love to see an MMO, like, truly massively multiplayer game where combat was not the primary focus of
gameplay. I completely agree with you.
Now, you say that, and I've heard
it
said before.
Tried it,
how would you do it?
I don't know. I think there's other things to do other than clicking on tons of dudes and selecting something from a hotbar.
But work is exactly what is needed to sustain more meaningful gameplay and gaming experiences. Most people simply aren't used to thinking about enjoyment and entertainment as work. I don't see the issue as whether gamers do work for their entertainment or not. I believe that even the most casual gamer puts in work over time. The most important factor is whether or not the work that is done is efficient, working towards something meaningful, or if the player's efforts are scattered and unorganized.
Right. So all those designer best practices that I was talking about can take something that's inherently boring and pointless, like a box where you pull a lever and don't really win anything, right, and turn it into something that's compulsive, right? Compelling. And the thing is, we can do this with video games as well, and, you know, not just slot machines, right? In a sense, we figured out a way to engineer our way around boredom, right? And take a relatively pointless game that's just about, like, clicking on things and not doing anything real and adding production values to it and turning it into something that a lot of people want to play, right? And this is key, right? It's about we've engineered our way around boredom to a certain point, right? So instead of improving the things about their own quality of life, They're now improving imaginary things in an imaginary world, right? But they're still exerting, you know, time and effort, right? It's just the effort is going somewhere different now. Now, in the process of going somewhere different, what happens to it? Well, a lot of it just is in this imaginary world, but some of it goes into the game designer's and game publisher's wallet, right, in the form of, you know, whatever, maybe a micropayment, maybe the price of the game and whatnot, right? So if you think about this objectively, right, engineering your way through a human defense and then profiting by that is a parasitic form of behavior. But I actually don't think, like, looking at this situation this way, like somebody is farming the players of Farmville, I don't think that this is hyperbole. I don't think it's any kind of distortion of reality, right? This is what is actually happening. Anyway, I mean, any time that I question current paradigms in game design, because I go to a lot of game conferences and talk to these people, game designers have a defense, which is just like, look, man, we're just giving people what they want. They want to play our game. They're having fun, right? That is true. I cannot exactly argue with that. People report that they're having fun, and certainly they pay money to play the game. But the fact is that, as we know from other areas of life, right, sometimes people want things that are not good, either not good for them or not good for people around them, right? Sometimes it's not good in a mild way, and sometimes it's not good in an extreme way. So as a game designer, you can make your own decision about whether you care that what they want is not good for them, right? Or about whether you want to exploit their susceptibility to vice and profit from it. My personal gut feeling is that all this Farmville stuff is just evil. It's not even mildly evil. It's like if you go and look at the discussions that happen day to day at those companies among the designers, they are very evil, right? They are about stuff like, how do we get people thinking about our game all day, every day, right? How do we get them to buy the maximum number of things that have the minimum amount of utility for them in their real life?
And figure out ways to be evil about stickiness, to make your game good and make people come back to it.
And for better or for worse, they're not afraid to talk about how you squeeze as much money out of each user as possible. I mean, that's really a lot of these guys' business. Now, I know that's kind of like a blanket statement. And those guys there who talk about the experience and talk about taking care of your user, I went to one session at Casual Connect that was specifically about that. But you have maybe, for one of those guys, you have three or four guys who basically just talk about how do you squeeze as much money as people as possible. What is like user acquisition, virality, all these crazy terms that they're using that really just treat people like cattle in a way to bring in the money as quickly as possible, and talking about how quickly you can do to clone a game, how quickly can you clone a game, and how much can return can you expect before that boom is over, and then you have to start looking for the next thing to clone.
There is an awareness of it. I mean, the Dreadmore talk that I went to, this guy was having this talk about writing humor in games, and he said in his talk, he said, this information is to be used exclusively for the purposes of good, not evil.
it's sad that you have to have that disclaimer.
There is this vague undercurrent of a clash of ideals happening in the games industry that wasn't around even like 2 or 3 years ago.
Games as technology drawbacks. There's not much of a drawback for the view of games as technology, but the potential of living inside of a virtual world blends the games as business view with the view of games as technology. And unlike the dream of flying cars by 2010, we have come far closer to simulating and rendering virtual worlds. Virtual reality headsets aside, these days we do a lot of our business and socialization and entertainment online. Some gamers, with a view of games as technology, value games for their ability to render worlds in detail and then escape into these worlds. So the closer games come to creating these virtual worlds, a feat only possible through advanced technology, the better.
well, what I'm going to just call Xenoblade 2 trailer.
Yes. Why don't I call it Dinosaur Planet 2 X?
I'm going to turn your mic off.
Come on. Dinosaur Planet 2 Planet X. That's what I call it.
Of a guy running up a cliff, getting in a mech, and flying off a cliff into like this expansive fucking...
This Come on, like, seriously, that didn't excite you?
No, that was cool.
Come on.
What dude. What the fuck do you want me to say? Yeah, it was
these are
cool.
Dinosaur Planet. What the hell?
It was there was a lot of dinosaurs. I'm going
to Terra brings some other things to the table that are truly special. And you can't the thing that everyone wants in an MMO is you get to a new area and you look around and you're like, "Oh, I mean that is the joy of an MMO." It's like, "Whoa." And boy, is that ever present in Terra, more so than any other game. It's just incredible.
Yeah. It's exciting to get to a new area because you get to see this cool new design. The graphics are amazing. It's Unreal Engine, but
I think it's going to be the next time someone's making a Skyrim-like game, it doesn't have to be a single-player role-playing game. It can be this massive role-playing game that we're all playing.
I mean, I think last week I briefly talked about the idea of a you know, Walking Dead feeling MMO where it's basically, you know, you're in a big open world and there's other people in that world and you have a starting area. But a lot of it is like
what happens when you kind of over polish your game is you kind of obfuscate some of the things in the simulation that are actually cool.
So for me, like I would love to work on something like an open world game where it's not based on, you know, these scripted missions that designers make, but it's more about letting you play with the systems. I mean, this is stuff that you see in like Eve or DayZ, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is, you know, I think this is kind of the future of games for me, at least. I think there's something, I think people like being creative. I like thinking people like playing the systems.
Mm-hmm. So do you like the idea of having a world that's sort of simulated and kind of going on its own and you drop the player into that and they figure out how to interact with that world? But because I think the downside of DayZ, and obviously as a mod and, you know, whatever, for a first step in that direction. But the downside for me was there wasn't enough going on already. You know what I mean? There were zombies wandering around. But the first few hours of playing DayZ, it seems like this infinite possibility of like just over that ridge, there could be anything. And sometimes there was cool stuff, but most of the time there wasn't.
Taking a city block, for example, and simulating that and fully simulating that in a computer environment, right? Yeah. So it's just a city block, but every apartment there is populated, every business is running, everybody's got their own routines. And yes, this is a nightmare from a processing perspective. But
what about the idea of not a massively multiplayer online game, but a sort of respectively multiplayer online, you know, where you get like a group of like 20 or 30 people in a world that is set up to do certain things, and those 20 or 30 people get to interact with that world, and it changes based on all the stuff that they did in it.
So it's you're still in control of everything that you're doing, but the world kind of goes on and has its own set of things.
It's a fascinating idea. I mean, it gets to almost like science fiction virtual reality idea.
Almost.
But
in a similar way that games, art, and learning don't work well unless the participant is willing to listen through their own intrinsic motivation, in order for games to be games, they have to be free from the demands, requirements, and real consequences of life. The lines get blurred somewhat with casino games because they're designed to foster compulsion and addiction. Likewise, living in a virtual world or a game world blurs the priorities of the player. To inject into a system designed with no real consequences the serious realities of life is to change a game into something that is not a game. It's to change it into a simulation. And games work best when they, as art and like art, reflect life, not become one's life.
You have freedom to do play a game how you want to play it. And in fact, a game compared to, say, work, you can stop whenever you want and just walk away. You have this huge level of freedom in games.
Games as technology, gamers typically value refinement, which can result in the rapid turning away of past design elements, products, and philosophies. It seems that when riding the wave of the future, you don't have time to look back.
There will be a way in which these things are able to be connected because of our faster things, technology, processing, internet, all that stuff. What reason is there for that, all that stuff, to not be connected and for us to not play things that way other than technical limitations?
I think Game Over is a vestige of an antiquated modality of gaming, where
put another quarter in.
Exactly.
It was Mark Cerny's talk about that a couple of times. He talked about it once at DICE that I watched.
Yeah, and so we've progressed beyond that. Why should I ever see those two words in a game ever?
And while this kind of attitude works well enough for technological and engineering pursuits, it doesn't work so well for artistic values. If works of art are statements made through mediums by artists, then in some ways there isn't anything to refine. The statement that is made, in all of its arbitrariness, is to be taken as a single immutable unit, a complete utterance to be accepted whole. But because video games are both artistic and engineered products, focusing mostly or exclusively on the engineering side comes at the cost of the art side, and vice versa.
Even two generation jumps ago, I was emotionally hoping that we'd stop just being focused on improving visuals in games and move on to, you know, better AI, better logic, and better core game mechanics underpinnings, like and having the hardware to support letting a programmer and designer do more with the game.
Games as art, the cost. The cost of embracing the view of games as art is that gameplay involves a reduction of oneself. This is what The Squeeze is about. To better work within the gameplay system, one's own opinions, ideas, tactics, strategies, and actions are squeezed tighter and tighter to better conform to the system. And by squeezed, I generally mean set aside, tweaked, and deleted to be replaced by strategies that actually work. By embracing challenging gameplay, you replace most of yourself with the system that is the game. There really isn't a lot of room for pride, hubris, or excuses.
Just, you know, and just so you don't think that I'm, you know, that it's all sweetness and light and I'm kind of romanticizing this, I actually think that one of the ways that, Go works as meditation is that it's a machine that you inject into your mind, and it expands to fill your mind until there's no room left for you in your own head. In this sense, it's actually quite destructive. It's a form of self-destruction. You know, there's a famous story, saying about chess. If you want to destroy a promising young man, you teach him how to play chess. And of course, the same is true of Go. And I'm sure many lives have been destroyed by chess and by Go, as they have by other games.
Just by playing games, it's clear whether or not we have what it takes. And this experience is hard to take for most people. I've said before that video games are inherently filled with repetition because learning is a fairly slow and repetitive process.
Because the game is an action-based game, what you're doing, instead of watching cooldowns, is you're watching the enemy, because they will flash, they will have tells, they will have certain actions that they do right before they attack you.
You gotta learn him. You gotta learn him.
Dan was always going, "Learn him!"
Yeah.
Well, video games are also filled with a lot of losing. And this losing doesn't just come from game over screens. It also comes from the loss of some of the weakest, unnecessary, prideful, and whiny parts of yourself. Gameplay is a process that changes us, and when various weaknesses are left behind, these changes are for the better. And the ideas we're left with from this real transformative process is why gameplay is art, why gameplay is powerful, why gameplay is meaningful, and there's nothing simulated, nothing catered to us and brought down to our narrow, low expectations. Rather, gameplay sets a bar high for us to reach to and grow towards at the same time. I clearly support the view of games as art, but I understand that there is much to appreciate from the other views. Also, I understand that blending these views can result in more varied, more interesting, and stronger products overall. Yes, many products that we call games these days aren't much of games at all. But instead of getting tangled up in the terms, I suggest going straight to the heart of the matter by asking what views you hold and how these views affect everything you think and love about video games. Understanding which view you hold is important for understanding yourself, communicating to others, and supporting the video game industry. And if you're unsatisfied with the games you play, consider if a more well-rounded viewpoint could work for you. Chances are, you're neglecting the games as art view.
People are going to get sick of the same thing. They're going to get, I mean, obviously there's gambling addicts out there, but it's not going to, you know, there's going to get to a point where gamers are, you know, they're going to start looking at their phones and thinking that they should be able to get the same experience that they've been getting off these consoles and, you know, these rich storytelling experiences that they haven't been able to get yet. That
or you could just base it all on Disney characters and
you just have gone completely nuts.
I know. I just want games to be
more, but you also completely took over Brandon's segment
I
there.
Know.
Well, man, are video games ever going to be anything more than what they are? Like, cause yeah, like a really nicely done, like violent, like lo-fi weird trip of a game is awesome, but it's not like, that's not helping us bridge over to that other alternate universe. And like,
I don't actually know if I agree with that.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree
because
with that.
Because it's Hotline Miami, the way that it does all the stuff that it does actually makes me notice that those things are happening. And I think true. That is.
I know that gameplay conveys much of the meaning that many gamers demand. I also know that gameplay systems can enhance the stories, meaning, and emotions in a game experience. I'm convinced that anyone who complains that games aren't there yet does not consider gameplay systems as a factor, or at least doesn't understand them well enough. I know that many gamers heavily rely on non-gaming elements to make their gaming experiences more enjoyable. A little story, music, and visuals go a long way in making video games more appealing and accessible to a wide range of people. But without a community and a culture to teach people what's valuable about gameplay or games as art, and without a language to describe what's great about games, most of these gamers will be largely unaware of gameplay at all.
It distracts from what should be just the interest in what the core game is. You know, what is the experience in that core game supposed to be like? It distracts from the discussion that we should all be having of just kind of what's happening with the medium, all these complex and interesting and nuanced things that are happening in the game design, and we're only talking about special editions.
This episode of Critical Casts considers what video games are and how they have evolved as products of entertainment in a rapidly growing industry. Games cannot easily separate from the unique relationship with technology and therefore business. But the art of games, game design, is something that can be utterly overlooked, invisible, and even lost if we fail to preserve it. Even the most hardcore enthusiasts, writers, critics, and the like in our industry are not necessarily good at talking about gameplay. In other words, the casual gamer is just as likely to miss out on quality gameplay discussions as the hardcore gamer or even the game designer. We only have to listen to the discourse around us to see how far we've come and how much the trigon view of video games explains how we think, what we want out of our games, what we value, where games are going, and why gameplay is invisible to the masses.
Our minds are full of the endless chatter of consciousness, and Go is like a single note, a sound created by striking this tiny corner of the universe, and it reverberates forever, and it fills your head with something that's like silence, like silence, like silence, like silence, like silence.
To make episode 3 of Critical Cast Trigon, I had to draw clips from the following sources: Weekend Confirmed, The Idle Thumbs Podcast, 8-4 Play, Camouflage Radio, Frank Lanz's GDC Talk, Life, Death, and the Middle Pair. Jesse Schell in The Pleasure Revolution, Why Games Will Lead the Way, and his talk titled Information Flow. I also drew some quotes from Jonathan Blow in his talk Video Games and the Human Condition. Adam Sessler from a couple of his Sessler's Somethings videos on YouTube. The Game Grumps episode 4 for Kirby's Return to Dreamland. A fighting game competition called X-Smash featuring PlayStation Battle Royale All-Stars and the commentators Kuntel and Peter. And Dan Pinchbeck from a GDC talk. The music in this episode is from Professor Layton in The Curious Village, The Legend of Zelda. I have the Ocarina of Time creation story at the beginning, the puzzle-solving sound effect played on guitar by Gilva Sunner from his YouTube channel, and the Mario and Zelda Big Bang live track CD number 15, the shop theme that you're listening to right now, Portal 2.
the songs are science, it's fun, and I am not a moron. Andy's Piano Mario remix and the Tetris theme. I also borrowed from Katamari's Fanfare theme. Then there's the Ghost Trick epilogue theme, The End of the Night, the RE4, that's Resident Evil 4's merchant quotes, and a couple of shop themes from A Link to the Past, and the eShop music from the 3DS. I also had Siri help me out in this episode with a quote, and a quote from Master Chief, the finishing the fight line, and a line lifted from the Intel's video on Moore's Law, starring the Mythbuster guys, Adam Savage and Jamie Hyneman. I didn't have room to include all the content I had prepared for this episode. I have more interesting segments for you to listen to, including two interviews from professionals working in the industry who are also fans of critical gaming. They provide contrasting views on many of the topics raised in this episode, but don't worry, I will include these interviews and this content on the B-side of this episode, so stay tuned for that. So you, listening to this right now, if you want to be a part of the discussion, if you have a comment, good or bad, about the ideas presented in this show, then join me in my open online recording session. If you don't want to voice chat, then you can leave an audio message on my Skype mailbox, or you can just leave a comment on my Facebook page or blog page, or just send me an email. You can find all the details you need to know on my blog at criticalgaming.com/podcasts. Thank you for listening. This is the Crazy Kirby Kid, and signing out.